I've got one question for you. Are you ready to get your game on?
The longest-running off-road and action motorsports radio show on the planet is coming to you live with the biggest guest in motorsports. Here is the only man on the planet who can pack this much dirt slinging and tire slaying into 2 hours a week. Sit back, strap in, and be prepared to get your ears blown. Here is Jim Beaver and the Down and Dirty Radio Show.
Good morning and welcome to the Down and Dirty Radio Show, lit up by Rigid Industries and schooled by Dirtfish Rally School. I'm your host, Jim Beaver, just like I have been for 3 years now. This is our third anniversary show, airing live today from Park City, Utah at the House of Hoon, Hoonigan Racing. Lots of guests on tap for today. We're going to have Ken Block calling in. Normally he's calling in, but today he is going to be here live since we're at Hoonigan Racing. We're also going to have Nitro Circus Ringmaster and one of the founders of Nitro Circus, Greg Godfrey. He's going to be stopping by. Also got an interview with Ivan Stewart I had the opportunity to do last week. So we're going to have the Iron Man's interview here live on the Down and Dirty Radio Show later on today. But I got to tell you, man, talk about a beautiful facility here in Park City, Utah, here at the home of Hoonigan Racing. It's pretty amazing. I'm lucky to be invited out here to do this. But this marks our third anniversary, 3 years. I won't say to the day, but right around here, it's been 3 years since we've been on air. And I got to tell you, it's been a roller coaster ride. Want to thank all of you who have been with us from day one and all of you that just started maybe listening in today. Maybe this is your first episode, but want to thank all of you because without you listeners, we wouldn't be where we're at today. So super stoked to, to have you guys on board, have you as fans, listeners. It's definitely been an uphill battle, but, I think we're winning the war at this point. But, any of you that have questions for Ken Block, shoot me over a tweet at JimBeaver15 on Twitter, and we will definitely get those questions asked to the head Hoonigan here in just a little bit. Also, Greg Godfrey, Nitro Circus founder, you got some Nitro Circus questions? Shoot them over at JimBeaver15. We'll ask Greg those later on in the show. Should be a great show today, but before we get into these interviews and really rolling out this 3-year anniversary, I do have a big, big, big announcement to make. This one's been 3 years in the making. Literally, we've been in negotiations for like 3 years, but stoked to announce today that we have ink on a contract, and Polaris Razor will be the presenting partner of the Down and Dirty Radio Show. So the show is going to be renamed starting January 1st, the Down and Dirty Radio Show, powered by Polaris Razor. Super stoked to have Polaris on board. Got to thank everybody at Polaris that helped make this happen. I think it's going to be a great partnership. It's also going to spread branding to the number 15 trophy truck. So you're going to see some Polaris Razor branding on there. You're probably going to see me driving around in some Polaris Razors, doing some events with Polaris, maybe racing them from a time or two. And I'm going to be doing some live radio. We're going to do Down and Dirty Radio Show live from a lot of Polaris consumer events. So Mint 400, I know that's back on the calendar. We're going to be live from the UTV World Off-Road Championships. We're going to be doing some stuff with Camp Razors. And possibly, who knows, maybe some Terracross events and a lot of other things. So very, very excited to make that announcement. I've been sitting on it for quite some time, though. Once in a while, I like to kind of tease you guys a little bit. And I was lucky enough to, past couple of weeks, be able to get some Polaris Razor athletes on air and tweet some stuff from Camp Razor and Instagram it. And so I don't know, maybe some of you caught on, maybe some of you didn't, but really, really stoked to make that announcement. Polaris, one of the greatest power sports companies in the world, and such a high quality machine. So I got to tell you, I'm excited to you know, to get a 1,000 myself, go out and slay some dunes and have some fun out in the desert. And who knows, maybe I'll strap on my race suit and show up at one of these UTV races and see how I compare with, you know, the likes of RJ Anderson. So should be a fun project. Thank you to everybody from Polaris who made that happen. It's definitely going to be a fun partnership, I think, for both parties. Also, I know you fans, we made the announcement a couple weeks ago, but Fantasy Supercross, Down and Dirty Radio Show Fantasy Supercross, we're debuting it this January. We've teamed up with the guys from FantasyActionSportsLeague.com. We're doing Down and Dirty Radio Show Fantasy Supercross. We have a title sponsor for that, and what that means is I can tell you what prizes you're going to be able to win. It's free to enter, and I got to welcome KMC Wheels. It's going to be the KMC Wheels Down and Dirty Radio Show Fantasy Supercross starting January 1st. And what we're going to do is we're going to give out some wheels to the winners. So that's right. You listeners, you want to get involved in some Fantasy Supercross, be following me on social media and on the website. We're going to make some announcements here in the next week or so where you can go and sign up for that. Free to sign up. And if you win, you're going to get a free set of KMC wheels for your ride. So definitely is going to pay to play, so to speak. So super stoked on that. Thanks to the KMC Wheels for getting involved with Fantasy Supercross and the Down and Dirty Radio Show. Looking forward to that. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And hopefully we can get some celebrity guests involved. I know a couple of the boys here at Hoonigan Racing already said they want to get involved in Fantasy Supercross. They want to play. So, yeah, not only are you going to be able to do battle on a weekly basis in Fantasy Supercross with me, some of the boys from Hoonigan Racing, and we'll reach out. Maybe we can get some pro riders on. You never know. But super stoked on that. And, yeah, it's, tell you what, flew into Park City yesterday and, here at, you know, came to Hoonigan Racing, got everything, set up and first time here. And I got to tell you, this facility, absolutely, absolutely amazing here in Park City. You know, with the shipping containers, you see the videos online, you see the tour. It really, really doesn't do itself justice. It's pretty amazing what, they were capable of doing with these shipping containers and what they actually did. You know, it's just, it really is mind boggling, you know, the way they're laid out, and it's so, they did it in such an elegant way. It's pretty trick, you know, and I'm definitely going to be posting some pictures from here, you know, throughout the day and who knows, probably the next week. But, yeah, you know, had a chance myself to see some of Ken's project cars, obviously race cars. I've seen them before. I saw the Hoonicorn at SEMA, but I didn't get a chance to get up close and personal. I actually got to sit in the driver's seat of the Hoonicorn. Wasn't allowed to turn it on, disappointingly. But, yeah, I got to tell you, that Hoonicorn is it's amazing. I mean, it's a one-off car. We all know that. But you know, what they were able to do with, I believe it's a 65 Mustang. I'll have to get the correct answer from Ken. 65, 66 maybe. Yeah, what they were able to do, all-wheel drive, sequential gearbox. I mean, it's truly one of a kind. And to see that big V8 packed in there, that Roush V8, yeah, it's a remarkable piece of automotive engineering. That's for sure. You know, I don't think when they invented the original Mustang, they ever would have fathomed that something like this would ever be, you know, would ever take place. You know, and just looking around this place, I mean, it definitely is a museum to all things Ken. You know, it's got some homage to you know, DC shoes. Obviously, he's got a collection of all of his, you know, all of his driving shoes over the years and some of his signature models. I mean, we've got remote control cars all over the place, you know, the Dirt video game series, you know, just different automotive chemicals, cleaners, anything he's lent his name to, signature sunglasses, t-shirts. It's pretty cool, you know, to see, you know, it's pretty cool to see, you know, what's going on, you know, kind of his legacy, you know, and he's only been involved in motorsports for about 10 years now. And I think that's what's, you know, that's what's super cool about it is, you know, he's got so many trophies. I mean, some of the stuff from Gymkhana Grid over in the, I got to tell you, there's one that's like this, you know, knights in shining armor. It's like a glove from a knight's, you know, armor. And, it's got a can of Monster in there, and it's from a Gymkhana Grid. And I mean, you know, it's just pretty remarkable. Some of the stuff just walking around here. I mean, you know, he's got some of the, some of the roller skates from Nick Schwartzen that they did that video piece for one of the Gymkhanas, and tires and wheels and X Games medals. It's I'm sitting here and at a table that's made out of skateboard decks. I mean, it truly is a pretty cool place, and to see the way it's all laid out, and then the shop back there is just absolutely spotless. So definitely, I would say this is I've aired at a lot of places. It's definitely got to be one of the coolest places the Down and Dirty Radio Show has aired, though. If you're just tuning in, this is the Down and Dirty Radio Show. We are live from Hoonigan Racing here in Park City, Utah. And if you got any questions, I know I got a couple listeners found that chat board that we've got snuck in there. But use the chat board to answer some questions. Also, use Twitter at JimBeaver15. Tweet me those questions. Anything for Ken? Anything for Greg Godfrey? We will definitely get those questions asked. Already got some Ken Block questions rolling in, and we will definitely get those answered for you guys. And it's going to be a heck of a show today. And like I said, we've got that interview with Ivan the Iron Man Stewart. And Ivan, he's had a tremendous career, and it seems like really the past 10 years since he's retired, he's even become more busy. So we definitely have look forward to airing that interview with Ivan the Iron Man Stewart. And then let's not forget Best in the Desert, Henderson 250. We're talking all this about Hoonigan Racing as we are here, Ivan Stewart, Greg Godfrey, Nitro Circus, but let's not forget Best in the Desert. They capped off their season 2 days ago at Henderson, Nevada. So Best in the Desert Henderson 250. We are going to get into that. We're going to break down all the results and these championship battles, as some of them were going down to the wire. Some of them, like Jason Voss, kind of had it in the bag. And I got to give congrats out to him for yet another overall victory. I mean, Jason, talk about a man on a mission. It's he's just it's insane. So we're definitely going to get to talking about the Best in the Desert Henderson 250 later on in the show. And then got some Race of Champions news, some new news coming out of off-road with a Trophy Truck World Championship that's going to be going on. And also some Snowcross news. Snowcross, big shakeup in the points with the disqualification. So we're going to get into that later on in the show. But looks like right now we've got the head Hoonigan himself. Looks like he's walking over the table. So we'll get Ken on air here in just a few seconds. And opening up a can of Monster. We'll get that sponsor plug in there for Ken. And yeah. Got to tell you, man, this place, the pictures don't do it justice, Ken.
Thank you. I I like to come work in a very nice creative atmosphere, and this does it for me.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know talking with the guys, I mean, this was a big, this was a long-term project. And, how did you even decide on this? I mean, with the shipping containers and then the layout, because, I mean, it had to have been one of those things. Once you even started, it was kind of just, you can't even blueprint something like this, can you?
The funny thing is when I started with Ford, my intention was not to have a race shop or office or anything. And, it was using M Sport to run the cars in Europe, and Andreas and his Allsburg's teams run the Fiesta here in America. And I just realized after a short bit that I wasn't so happy not having complete control over the car and the teams, with what we were doing in the States. So we decided, okay, we got to find a path to run our own cars, run all of our own equipment, have our own motorhomes, all that sort of stuff, which, you know how it is. It means a lot more overhead. Yeah. It means, carrying a lot more equipment on the books and having a place to store it all. So the idea of putting this place together finally came to fruition, mainly because, like I said, I didn't want to have to do that all myself, but eventually I decided I had to control sort of my destiny, especially with the cars here in America. So when we sat down and said, okay, well, what does a Hoonigan Racing shop look like? And unfortunately, I have this problem that I can't do things half-ass. And everything that I do has to represent what we do in a certain way. And so for me, we looked at a whole bunch of different sort of designs and direction, and not only did we want something that functioned really well as a race shop, you know, to where we could service cars, do the repairs, store everything that we needed to store, you know, from spares to the mountains of tires that we have. But that also, on the creative side, with all the marketing and everything that we do and with all the sponsored interaction and all that stuff, we wanted something that would also represent us and inspire us. And so that's why we came along with this sort of shipping container design and the very creative design and the look of it and everything. Just was all something that we wanted to all fit together that represented what I do and how we do it.
Yeah.
So your question was really about the shipping containers, yeah. And I gave you the long story intro of it. The shipping containers, I like the look of it. There's certain creative agencies that have been doing the shipping containers, like out in L.A., as their offices. The great thing about shipping containers is there's a bigger investment up front, but the idea is that you can take it with you. If you rent a warehouse space and build out offices, you can't take that drywall with you. So this entire place was built with the idea of if the team expanded a couple years, if I was running 3 or 4 cars, or if I was, you know, scaling back my program and didn't need this much space, we would be able to take all this and move to a bigger building, a smaller building, or maybe someday I'll own my own building with a test facility, you know, out back. So, you know, that was kind of the thought process that went into building this place, was that I wanted to invest in stuff that I could own for a long time. And depending on our size and if we needed to move, I could take it with me.
Yeah. It was instead of going the double wide route, you went with the shipping containers, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty remarkable. I mean, you know, in mentioning that, talking about the team, I know one of our first fan question was, we can slide that one in right now, but had a fan write in and from Brazil, actually, is any possibility that Ken at some point in time expands to a 2-car team?
It's possible. I would love to take sort of this machine that I've built and help develop other driving talent, especially younger guys that may not have, you know, the opportunity. Motorsports is just so expensive, and you know it takes a lot of effort nowadays, especially to make the sponsors happy and go get the sponsors money. And I'm sure you hear it from all the different people that you talk to, from off road to rally to everything, that like, you know, it's so hard to find sponsorship to go pay to go out and have fun. And unfortunately, that's just the reality of it. And I would like to at some point take this machine that we've built and be able to develop and help more talent. So, that's the main thing I would like to do. You know, if the sponsors really came along and said, hey, we'd like you to have 2 cars. The problem is when you ask most of my sponsors, would they rather pay for a second car or pay for me to go do more events? They would actually rather have me go do more stuff around the world. So that's what ends up happening. We have Monster come in and say, okay, we want you in Korea and Japan and Spain and in Italy this year. So instead of that money going towards an additional car, it goes towards me being flown in different places around the world to do different events for those sponsors.
Well, and that's going to be cool for you, though, because your brand is so global. I mean, a lot of drivers are known in the United States and outside of, you know, East and West Coast, you know, and everything in between. You know, they're not really known worldwide. But, I mean, you're able to go to Italy and, you know, you've got such a fan base there, or, you know, South America and all these other places. And it's got to be kind of cool for you.
Yeah, definitely. I sit in a very lucky place in the world of motorsports, with the things that we've done, you know, marketing wise, and definitely with the message that I've had about having more fun with the vehicles. And I think most people, you know, have put out there as a message, I've definitely attracted more people. And, you know, it's amazing. Like, I'm, you know, I was just in Italy, you know, a week and a half ago. And although I had a crappy event and was not very happy with my personal performance, you know, the fans still came out and supported me and wanted to hang out and get autographs and photos and all that stuff. So, you know, it's really amazing how that fan response has been over the years. So I'm really appreciative of all the fans that really come out and support me. And it's been an amazing, you know, response all over the world.
Yeah. Well, when you started rally racing 10 or so years back, I believe a little over 10 years, right?
This is my 10th year.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, did you ever fathom where you'd be now? I mean, you know, you figure you were just going to go and do a few events here and there. I mean, do you ever fathom, you know, you have this facility and be, you know, going around the world?
No, it's, you know, I started off doing it just for fun. It literally was like a dream come true thing. Like, I watched it as a kid. I followed, you know, all through the groupie era and then watched Colin McRae in the 90s and then as it grew in the 2000s and watching the car developments and all that stuff. So it really was when I started just going out to do something that I dreamed of doing as a kid and that I mimicked with my own cars as I, you know, drove and got my own cars. So, you know, the first year was literally just and the thought of going out racing with Travis and having fun, you know, and just trying my hand at it. And ended up being rookie of the year that year in Rally America and, you know, showed that I had a bit of talent. And from there, I just put a lot of work in to develop myself. And I've never had a goal of like, hey, I want to be champion or hey, I want to be world champion. It's always just been to go out and have fun and develop my skills, to try and develop my skills as far as I possibly can. Because I started kind of late in life and it really was, you know, something that I did as really a – you know, sort of an afterthought, if that makes sense. Because yeah. I grew up skateboarding, snowboarding.
Yeah.
I rode and raced dirt bikes, you know, never, you know, at a high amateur level, never at a pro level. But, you know, so racing cars was not something that, like, I started off as a kid. My dad didn't put me in a cart, you know, when I was young and go that whole route even the nowadays, you know, a lot of people are putting kids in, you know, the small off-road trucks and that sort of thing. Or in Europe, they have like the Folk Series in Sweden or rally, you know, the rallycross stuff that they start very young, you know, in like Finland. They're, I didn't do any of that. None of it. So I literally didn't get into a race car until my mid-30s. So really, for me, it's always been just a goal of going out and having fun and trying to just develop my skills as far as I can.
Yeah. Well, talking about that and going out and having fun, obviously Gymkhana series where we just you just dropped number 7. You know, and last I checked, I can't remember, but last I checked like 16, 17 million views, but that was like a week ago. So I don't know where we're at now, but you know, talking about that, I mean, you know, you've had all these different iterations, and I know talking with you in the past, you said you were point blank. You're like, you know, we created a problem because we've gone so big that it's hard to one up ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, but you, somehow each time you find a way to do it. And I mean, this time Los Angeles, the Hoonicorn. I mean, you know, pretty wild.
So what's the question?
Yeah.
Those are great statements. Thanks.
No, I mean, you know, how did the Hoonicorn come about? Because talking with the guys around the shop and stuff, I know that was not like something that was built overnight. I mean, this was a project car, you know, took a couple years to build, right?
Yeah, I mean, for me, like you said, like every time that we do these things, I have the challenge to one-up what we've done in the past, and that's not very easy. And really, the biggest one being Gymkhana 5 was a really tough project, and I knew when I got done with it, I kind of screwed myself that one was going to be so good that it was going to make all the other ones, you know, kind of pale in comparison, and it really did. It, you know, being able to shut down, you know, the areas of San Francisco and be able to drive the way that I did from, like, the jumps, you know, to being out on the barge to the bridge, all that stuff was just insane. Like, I'm very, very fortunate that I've been able to do that sort of thing and create that sort of video. And the driving was really fun in that one too. So, you know, when we set out to do, you know, 6 and 7 and even looking forward to 8, 9, 10, whatever, you know, I have all these ideas of things that I would like to do. And some of them are a bit crazy and some are somewhere in the middle, you know? And so, you know, around this time of year, every year we get together and start hashing through the ideas and, you know, see how the fans respond to different things so that we can apply some of that feedback to what we want to do in the future. And it really is quite a long process to go from like an idea to a finished project, especially with something like the Hoonicorn. And the thing is with that, I just always wanted to do something with a car that was completely unexpected. And especially making something like that all-wheel drive, something that when it was introduced, it was never all-wheel drive. Someone made one for the snow for someone, I think, delivering mail somewhere. but it was never built as a performance car. Yeah. And the all-wheel drive systems really, as far as racing, came in, you know, in the mid to late 80s, and in the 90s and 2000s, it was really developed a lot further along. So, you know, taking a car that was built in the 60s, long before the all-wheel drive systems was really perfected, and putting this system in there and then driving it a way that's really quite unnatural for that car was just something I really thought would be sort of shocking to a lot of people and quite dynamic at the same time. So that was the initial simple thought, to do something with an all-wheel drive system that was just completely unexpected. So thus we ended up with the 65 Mustang.
Yeah. Well, and talking about that car, I mean, obviously you guys built it. We know the capabilities now from watching Jim 7. I know it's obviously going to make tour around and do a lot of shows. Any chance we see it maybe do a Gymkhana Grid event or something?
It's possible. The main thing was getting it built and then getting this video done. And then beyond that, you know, we just haven't had much clarity as to what the sponsors will want us to do with it and that sort of thing. And I mean, I would love to do it with Gymkhana Grid with it. I'd love to go somewhere like Gapville or Goodwood with it. Yeah. There's been several requests, you know, from different places around the world, New Zealand, South Africa, stuff like that, for me to bring it out and do different things. So, yeah, it's just a matter of how it aligns with my different sponsor requests and different events and that sort of thing. So we'll figure that out in the next couple of months and have a schedule for it. But seriously, like that thought hasn't been, you know, really anything at all, because the video we just put out 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly.
So now it's a matter of kind of figuring out what we do with it in the future. And the thing about it is, it is by far the funnest car I've ever driven. So I can't wait to drive it again. And unfortunately, it's not like I have a lot out in the backyard that I can just go drive it anytime I want. It's the only time I get to drive these things is when, you know, generally I do an event, you know, or go shoot a video, that sort of thing. So I probably won't drive it again for 3 or 4 months till we have it somewhere to do some sort of event. So I'm looking forward to that. So I hope there's a lot more requests for it to go do things. You know, Monster keeps me pretty busy every year with those sort of, you know, Gymkhana Grid events or demos. So hopefully, you know, one of those will be up in the early part of the year so I can go drive it.
Yeah. Well, talking about this year and some of the events, obviously, you know, you did a few stage rally events, probably not as many as you'd liked, but let's talk a little bit about GRC. You guys, you know, ended last year on a good note, winning in Vegas, come into this year, and, I mean, you came out swinging in Barbados, you know, leading the race. We obviously kind of know what happened there. But, you know, this year, I mean, week in, week out, I mean, you guys, I mean, heat race wins. I mean, you guys were absolutely the fastest car on course. That'd be pretty exciting for you with the GRC program to see how it's progressed.
Yeah, you know, last year, meeting 2013, I actually had a really good year, but unfortunately in the points, final points and the number of wins and sort of stuff like that, it didn't really play out. I mean, I was the fastest qualifier and won the most heats. So that's what you want to do as a race car driver, to set yourself up to be, you know, in the best spot in the main. Unfortunately, in 2013, being on the front row in the main was pretty bad because, you know, the courses weren't designed as well. We had more dirt corners, and they weren't, you know, the organization of GRC wasn't penalizing people as much for taking people out in the first corner. So I got taken out a lot in 2013. And so, you know, I ended up third overall in the championship. But I knew coming into 2014 that we had a good setup with the car. The stuff that I had learned and what I was doing with the car was quite good. And so we just basically for 2014 just developed even more with what I was doing and what the team was doing with the car. So, you know, once again this year I was fastest qualifier of the whole championship, won the most heats, and I had two wins. So on that side of things, I'm extremely happy. And even looking into 2015, you know, I'm going in again with a lot of confidence. Hopefully I can minimize some of the bad luck and errors on my part and hopefully be standing on top of the podium at the end of the year as opposed to getting second. So, but, you know, the team put in a really good effort. You know, if it wasn't for, you know, maybe just the mistake at Barbados or the mistake in Seattle, I would have easily won the championship. But it is what it is. I lost championship by 5 points, which is only one position, and it is what it is. I can't be too bummed about it. Yeah. But, you know, it was really disappointing, though, to lose out on that. It sucked actually going across the finish line in Vegas and knowing that Yoni was one position behind me in second, knowing that I didn't have what it took to win the championship. All I needed is one person between me and him, and I would have won the championship. But it is what it is, and had a great time racing this year, and look forward to next year.
Yeah, you know, and I know, you know, you went over, I believe, for the first time, ran some RX events with World RX this year. How was that?
It was really good. I enjoyed racing those events. You know, I only did two, but they were real rallycross tracks. You know, rallycross has been around in Europe, you know, 20 or 30 years. So there's a bunch of rallycross tracks around Europe that are all built in, that are all quite good. And that's the reason why I really wanted to go over there and race those, because our GRC tracks here in America are all tracks that are built temporarily for that event. We don't have any permanent tracks whatsoever. So I wanted to go over and race, you know, against, you know, that top level competition that they have over there in Europe, and do it on these tracks that are permanent facilities. So it was really cool to go over there and do that. And, you know, some of the entries, you know, on those events, you know, was like 40 or 50, you know, supercars, which is incredible considering we only have, you know, on average probably 15 here in GRC. So it's cool to be able to go over there and get a third and get a fourth, you know, in a series that, you know, I don't know at all on, you know, on tracks that, you know, I didn't know whatsoever till I arrived. So it was a really cool experience, and I hope I get to do more sometime in the future.
Yeah. Well, and skipping over and talking about WRC a little bit, I know, you know, you always make it a point to try and at least do one WRC event. You guys in the past have, you know, as a team of you know, you used to be named the Monster World Rally Team.
Yeah.
You know, what's it take for an American or an American team to go over there and compete? Because I think a lot of people think, oh, you know, we've got all these drivers here. You know, Ken could go over there and, you know, he could win the championship. He just needs funding and stuff. I mean, what does it really take for an American to go over there and be competitive? Because you've been pretty competitive and scored points at, you know, at some rounds.
Yeah, you know, the biggest thing is you need to do it for many years, and you need to do it at the right level. And that was the unfortunate thing for me, is when I went to do the WRC, I wanted to do it as a three-year program, do every event, and do it with a second car so that I would have someone to help me, you know, do all the testing and learn. And unfortunately, I had a program all set up to do that. And right before we started racing in 2010, one of my top sponsors dropped out of their commitment. So unfortunately, I didn't have the program that I needed to go achieve at the top level. But I still went and did it. I did 7 events the first year, 9 the next year, and had to cut it back to 3 the next year. And you know, and unfortunately, it's all budget related. It really is. It's so expensive, you know, to go race WRC at the top level, and you really need to do all the events, get all the testing in. There's no way to compare against the top drivers in the world that are on a factory team that are testing constantly and doing all the events and have that whole support. There's just no way to go battle those guys without the entire full commitment, and I just never had that budget to go do that. So anyway, I'm answering your question in kind of like how it worked for me.
Yeah.
You know, so really an American could do it just as, you know, a French driver could do it, you know, or a Finnish driver or a Canadian driver. It's a matter of really having the experience with the events and having the budget to be able to go out and do it consistently, because you need to go back to these events several times. You know, the first year you go to, say, WRC France, you write your notes from scratch. Then you race the event, you get that experience. You come back a year later, you take those notes that you wrote the year before, and now you're going to do 2 passes of recce on those notes and make them even better. So the thing is, most of the drivers that drive these cars can drive them quite quick. I can drive these cars, you know, almost at the same level as some of these top drivers. But the problem is I have such little experience with writing the notes and wrecking the notes. Yeah. And then once I go to these events, you know, I was doing it on such a limited basis that there was no way to really get the notes up to the right level, because I just wasn't doing it as consistently as they were. So that's the kind of the dark art that a lot of people don't understand about rally, that, You know, to be out there racing on those roads at that level, you have to be a very, very talented driver. And on top of that talent inside the car, you've got to have this whole other talent with the pace notes and be able to write these notes to get you down the road, not only quickly to be able to really identify where you can go fast, but also where the tricky spots are and where you can easily go off the road or hit something by accident that could, you know, break a control arm, that sort of thing. So it really is a much deeper art with rally than a lot of people understand.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes that people, you know, it's just not the outright speed that wins the races.
Yeah, well, it is outright speed, but there's a lot that goes into that outright speed and a lot that you just never see. You see these nice clips of guys racing down the stage, and it looks amazing, and it you know, the sport is genuinely an amazing sport, but there's so much in it behind the scenes. It's just, you know, it's similar to like the Baja 1000. Yeah. Like, you know, the guys that win that have spent weeks down there, you know, driving that road and prepping for it and all that. But the average fan doesn't see that. All they see is so-and-so won, and here's a couple photos of them winning, you know?
Yeah, they see the finish line. They don't see the months that they spent, you know, in Baja, you know, without a shower, you know, pre-running the race. So, well, talking about, you know, a little bit of rally, stage rally, let's talk a little bit of vintage rally cars, because obviously you were a big rally fan. I know, you know, walking through the building, you got a vintage rally car there, and I know you've got a few of them. I mean, let's talk a little vintage rally cars. What are some of your favorites?
I mean, my favorite car really, and probably in the world, is the Ford RS200 from the Goupy era. It was basically built right at the end of the Goupy era of rallying, and as they canceled the Goupy era, it was one of the cars that was just being perfected for it and only ran, you know, a short amount of time, and then basically was retired. So there was a bunch of them that were made, you know, as road cars as part of the homologation. There were a bunch that were raced, you know, and so you'll see various different forms of that car around the world that, you know, after they were used in rally, a bunch of them were then used in rallycross. So yeah, that's my, by far my favorite rally car in the world. The other one is the Mark II Escort, which I own a 1978 Mark II Escort, and bought it a couple of years ago. I've tried to race it twice and it just broke both times because basically it was built in England to run tarmac rallies, and we brought it over here and tried to run it in some gravel rallies, and it just wasn't built for it. And it's one of those things when I bought something for too cheap, and it just didn't hold up for what I was doing. So we've gone back and rebuilt it some, and we're going to use it for some different stuff fairly soon, because it was, if I ever go back and do more gravel rally with it, actually, with that type of car, I'll go buy a specific car for doing that.
Yeah.
That car just was never built for it. So we'll see. I love that. Love that car, and the chassis and everything, the way that you drive that car, you know, it's a rear-wheel drive rally car. It's just completely different than, you know, anything else that I've driven, you know, in my career. So I really enjoy it because it's such a big challenge. I suck at it. It's I can go fairly quick with it, but not as quick as a lot of the like top level guys that drive those Escorts, you know. But that's why I bought it. I want to get that experience for the long run. Someday when I stop racing, you know, the Fiestas at the top level, that's going to be my go-to for going out and having fun on stage rallies.
Yeah. Well, you feel like driving some of the older vintage rally cars and stuff like that, I mean, give you a lot of respect for how far technology has come.
Yeah, absolutely. But the amazing thing, though, is like that car, you know, it still handles amazing. Like, they're really fun to drive. And the way that they've set them up, you know, back then and even now, you know, with modernizing some of the equipment, it's still an incredibly handling car, and it's quite quick. So I'm looking forward to the day that I get to go back and do more of that stuff. Yeah. It's not going to be any time too soon because I'm so busy with everything else I'm doing, but someday I will.
Yeah. Well, and talking about rally, I mean, it's not just you, but your whole family. You know, you go to the events and you know, your wife, your kids are all there. It's really become a family-type atmosphere for you, and that's got to be pretty cool to be able to have your family involved. I know your wife does some stage rally here and there. So, you know, it's got to be cool for you to have your family involved with everything you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my wife is very dedicated to our relationship and our family and wants to be at as many events as she can possibly get to and brings the kids out. And my kids have just grown up with it. You know, one time my daughter, you know, said, got home from school and was like, "Daddy, my friends don't believe that you're a race car driver." And for them, it's just, it's standard. I mean, my kids can name everyone in the GRC series and know their cars. And my three-year-old is actually the one that knows them the best, you know. And it's just a matter that that's the way that they've been brought up and they really love it. And for me, it's great to have them along on, I don't know, roughly 70% of the events. And it's great to be able to share that experience with my wife and enjoy, you know, our relationship, being able to travel the world together and then bring the kids along and have them experience life in such a bigger dynamic way than just sitting at home.
Yeah. So we're getting a couple of fan questions in, one from earlier and then some more rolling in. But as we wind this down, first one, obviously, it's about Formula Drift. And wondering if, you know, you do a lot of, you know, obviously drifting with Gymkhana videos and stuff like that. Is there a chance we ever see Ken one off a Formula Drift event and say a Mustang or something?
Most likely, no. I mean, like anything, you know, the guys that drive that stuff and the cars and everything are so specific to that. And those guys are competing at such a high level now, from, you know, Vaughn and Forsberg and Saito, all those guys. It's amazing what they do. I really enjoy watching them. I'm friends with a lot of those guys. They're just so talented. But my entire career really is all wheel drive. Like, that's my experience. That's all my intuitions, everything go to what an all wheel drive car does. So getting into a rear wheel drive car and trying to do that, it's possible. It would just take a bunch of time for me to get to those guys' level. It's, yeah, you know, it's not something that you can just jump into a random car and expect, oh yeah, I can go compete at the top level of Formula Drift. It just isn't possible. And that to me, that's sort of discrediting what those guys do to think that I could jump in and do that, you know. Yeah. It's I have my talents in what I do, and they're incredibly talented in what they do. So for me to just be able to transfer over to what I do to rear-wheel drive and in a tandem style just isn't realistic for me to think I could go do that.
Yeah. And kind of lead into the next question that we got. But basically, putting you on the spot, we're going to see a Gymkhana grid in the United States anytime in the next year or two.
I would love to. It's on my list of things to look at for next year. But the thing for me is, like, I am not an event organizer. I just am not. Like, I own the trademark. I own the series. And Monster has been great with doing the series over in Europe. And for me, it's a completely hands-off thing. We help advise on a few things for them. But they run that series and have me over for the final event, and it's awesome. I don't have to do that much. Yeah. But for me to go do it here in the States, it's a lot of work. It's hiring of people and managing and money and time, and it's just something I don't have time for at this point. So eventually, you know, once my career slows down, maybe I will get back to something like that. But we'll see. The biggest bummer really for me was when we had such a great Gymkhana Grid event at X Games in 2013, and then X Games moved to Austin, and at Circuit America's course, they didn't have a piece of tarmac big enough for us to do the event there. So I chose to not do the event at all with them because, you know, they had a piece of tarmac that would have been substandard to me, you know, compared to what we had at Irwindale. So I chose to not be a part of X Games because I didn't want it to be mediocre. Hey. So, you know, then that was a tough decision.
Yeah. You can come and sit down, Greg. We got Greg Godfrey from Nitro Circus.
You have to go around the back?
Yeah.
No one answered the front door?
So we'll just throw him on here with Ken and I and roll with it. So, yeah, we're just kind of free-flowing here. But how's everything going, Greg? Oh, let me there we go. We got you mic'd up now.
Yeah, things are good. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, no worries.
Oh, it's always good seeing you, Greg.
Yeah.
I like you in places like this where you can't hurt me somehow or challenge me to do something stupid.
Well, the day's not over.
Hey, always got ideas in the back of your mind, right?
Oh, when I walk through that shop, I'm just like, whoa.
Did you see my new toy out there?
The
Mustang?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I told you. I was really upset about that.
Why were you upset?
Because I'm jealous.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Yeah.
That's the correct reaction.
Yeah, the rally cars and that, I mean, they're cool and everything, but when you're starting to get into the old school American muscle, now that's more into my territory, and I'm getting a little...
It's funny how many people have actually responded like that to that car, even guys like Ellis.
Yeah.
You know, who's... I've known Ellis forever, and he really likes this, you know, says he likes the stuff I do, but then he says... When he sees the Mustang, he's like, okay, now you're finally in something that I can relate to and I like. So, yeah, it's kind of funny. Typical reaction out of a lot of people.
Well, you know, I don't know if you knew this or not, but I brought the Mastercraft guys in here like a week ago or 2 weeks ago. You were gone. You were gone to New York. I was trying really hard to get that car started.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it would start right now.
Your guys were freaking out. You can't do this, Greg. And I'm like... Oh, Ken won't mind.
Yeah, that was.
I know you'd freak out. But
I was yesterday. I'm walking around here, and Dan and Butch are back there, and Butch goes, "Well, you can sit in it." I'm like, "All right." And he looks at me. He's like, "Don't try starting it."
Just take it for a spin around the block.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, they're already arguing because they just got to go down the street for a photo shoot, and they're already arguing who's going to get to drive it down the street. So.
It'll be fun.
Yeah, exactly. So what's new with you? I know, you know, getting ready to, what, New Zealand tour coming up for Nitro Circus and some other stuff, right?
Yeah, all the boys just got back from Dubai, Abu Dhabi. It was kind of a hard show. The ramps weren't quite right. My nephew almost died, and we broke, J2, he broke his wrist, and there was a couple injuries, and so we're just trying to recover from that and get ready.
So is that a local builder, basically, down there?
In Dubai?
Yeah.
A local builder that built the ramp?
Yeah.
It must have been. I don't know for sure, but it was pretty bad. It was our ramp, I think, from Europe, but something was up with it.
Really?
It wasn't right. So.
Huh. Interesting. No,
definitely a bummer. Well, I know the guys and girls have been throwing down over there on the East Coast quite a bit. I've been getting text updates, and I know I'm on a gag order, but some of the stuff has been pretty insane.
Oh, who put you on a gag order?
Jolene.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's just this typical mayhem. I mean, it's just nonstop. Travis is, it's a funny thing. He's in this state of mind where he's just, it's, you know, he's always been about tricks, but he's even, you know, even more possessed right now of trying to, you know, push the envelope and get some new stuff going on. So we've had, there's been a few people hurt this year, but in my opinion...
Only a few.
I like that it's not that Travis has been hurt. It's that other people have been hurt.
No, he's been hurt too.
Oh, okay.
I think he broke his wrist when he went in the straight rhythm down there when he flipped that thing.
Oh, really?
He didn't tell anybody, but yeah. Yeah, it wasn't bad. It was just a cast for a couple weeks.
But just like from impact on landing or from a crash?
No, did you see him when he flipped? He was blasting that last section of whoops.
Yeah.
And then he would hit that last jump, and it was like a 30-foot jump. And, of course, he's hitting it three times with the speed everybody else is, and then he has to flip it. Did you not see that?
Yeah, I saw it.
And he hit and blew his wrist off.
Oh,
right there, he got something.
Okay.
But for Travis, it's funny because you watch him, and his adrenaline's going, and it's like, oh, I'm fine, and then it kicks down, and he's home. Never ending.
Yeah, well, let's go back to the start with Nitro Circus because, I mean, it was kind of like Gymkhana was built. It started out as kind of nothing and it just blew up, you know, and I know you guys were doing some, just basically filming some shenanigans and it literally took off.
Shenanigans.
Well, you know, that's the easiest way to put it. I mean, it was, you know, the stunts and stuff were just nuts, but you were filming it and, you know, and it caught on. People, you know, started buying the videos at that time. And
yeah, you know, it was... At the beginning, I think it was him doing stuff and me doing stuff and then me trying to produce it and bring it together and trying to make sense of it all. And everybody hated the name to begin with, which I thought was quite interesting. It's kind of worked out. But, you know, Ken was there right pretty much from the beginning. No, you were, I'm trying to think, were you in the second one, the third one? It was like pretty quick.
Yeah, one of those.
But he called me and he's like... I don't even know how it came about, but we started talking. I truly don't remember, but he's like, can we do this? Can we do that? And kind of evolved. And That was fun right in the beginning because that was the beginning of the Gymkhana days. I think it was the third film.
Yeah, I think so. Was that when we did the stuff out at your at the trucking place?
In the Salt Flats.
Oh, yeah. And then Ken, I ran you over.
Ken hit me with the car. That could have been so horrendous. Totally my fault, but I fell off the front of his car, wheel spinning, and for some reason my hands didn't get caught in your rear wheel, and it just punted me. I mean, completely punted me from the car. But that's all. Yeah, it evolves and it progresses, and you start to find people that you enjoy working with and want to do things with, and it's kind of gone into this other monster now with live shows.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
On the early videos, how much did you edit and how much did Travis edit?
I edited probably about 90% of it.
Oh, okay.
He did come in and help, though, and he was quite, you know, he helped. He was good.
Do many people know that he actually does some of that
no,
stuff?
No.
That's what's interesting.
Yeah.
Because I didn't, and I was giving him shit about some of the edits and, like, how quick things were clipped together. He's like, oh, that's the part I love. That's the part I do. I was like, oops, I guess I shouldn't say that.
that's how his brain's functioning. You know, that was fun because he didn't know anything about film and all that, and brought him in and taught him, and he really adhered to it, and he was pretty stoked about it. That's how Baja came about, actually. We were sitting one night at working really late and get up in the morning, and Travis goes, you know, we should solo Baja this year. And it was literally a month before the race. It was the longest one. And anyway, we went down and did that. It was quite an adventure.
Was that the year you finished and he didn't?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I like that story. I beat him in one thing in my life.
Yeah. As long as no one knows the details of how it actually happened, it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah. Tortoise in the hair, man.
Yep.
I just stuck with it. I knew it was humanly impossible to go at that speed, at that distance, or at that level. And Travis was like, I can do it. So. Yeah, it was good.
But how was that? I mean, that was a crazy endurance event. I mean, you know, for you to go to Baja, and I mean, well, at that time, I know this year was like 1,300 miles. It was over 1,000 that year, right?
No, I think it was 1,300 that year.
Was it? It was full 1,300?
Because I did part of it.
You did, didn't you?
Yeah. In one of the wide-open cars for Monster, yeah.
Yeah. No, it was a beast. And at that time, now you go down there now, and there's a lot of pavement in the 1,000, and that thing was... There, when I got to the 1,000-mile mark, I've done a lot of endurance stuff in my life, and I was like, is this possible? Am I really going to get through this?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was good. It was good. Not like this man. I haven't raced like this man and done the things he's done. So.
Yeah, but I've never done Ayersburg.
Yeah.
You've done Ayersburg.
Yeah, that's a couple times.
Screw that place.
did I ever tell you the story about McGrath over there?
Uh-uh.
Oh, this is a good one. So Jeremy comes over there, and it's like, you know, these guys are unbelievable riders, but Ayersburg's a different animal. So McGrath's riding with us. We're free riding, and Jeremy's out there, and he's like, you know, he's an amazing rider, and he's doing things none of us can do, and Travis is even having a hard time. And McGrath's like, you know, this is not going to be that hard. I'm like, Ayersburg's weird, man. It gets you, and he's like, oh, this is easy. Just because it's hard for you guys doesn't mean it's hard for me. I'm like, well, okay, maybe this is the truth, you know. Yeah. But Jerry comes out, and that year, I hole shotted because somehow, and get out front so I didn't get roosted. And then David Knight passed me, and then Travis passed me, and then a couple of the Euros. But all of a sudden, I'm coming through this section. It was probably 10 miles out, and I just hear two-stroke just coming up on me, bouncing off the rev limiter. I'm like, who in the hell is this? And all of a sudden, I look back, and it was Jeremy McGrath. You know, here's seven-time Supercross champion and stupid little old me. And he comes up behind me, and he hits a tree, hits like a stump, and da-da-da-da, right over the handlebars. And he flies into these trees. I'm like, Jeremy, what are you doing? Oh, da-da-da-da. I go, calm down. You can't do this. This is an endurance race. Gets back on the bike, and I keep going. I go, you need my help? No. Get back on the bike. I'll go another mile. All of a sudden, da 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 da, crashes again. Goes flying off a cliff. I'm like, McGrath, you've got to calm down, man. You're not going to make it. But then he finally got the mentality of why everybody struggles over there, because they push too hard, too fast, and blow out. But it was pretty amazing, you know.
So how long did it take you to finish?
That year, it took me. I think I almost beat Jeremy. He did pass me. He beat me my bike. But I was just over under 5 hours.
And did Knight win?
Oh, yeah.
And how many hours?
Yeah, he beat me by 4 hours. don't talk about that.
I know, but that's just what's ridiculous. Like, those guys that ride that style of event, like, I can't fathom how they get through that stuff so quick. Doesn't make sense.
Well, I think it's a lot like when you go over and race at WRC, you know. It's just the level those guys are at compared to where we're at, you know. But you're catching up. You're catching up on that stuff.
Yeah, but But that's a really special talent, though, yeah. that Knight has. Like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and then Teddy Bluziak, and now there's a new kid coming out, and I can't remember who won it this year. But I asked Teddy. I saw him at another race, and I said, he's won it like 3 times. I said, you going to go back? And he goes, I'll go back if you go back. And I said, I'm not going back. I'm done. So, but even on top of that, that Romaniax was tougher than any of them. That was the worst one. Mm. That was just absolute slaughter on your body. So. Yeah, Baja's quick. It's a sprint. Ayersburg's 1 day. Romaniax was 7 days. That crap. It's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, by far. And they say it's harder than Dakar, but I haven't done Dakar, so I can't say. What are you going to do? When are you going down and do Dakar?
I don't know. When I get done doing the stuff I like doing now. But, I mean, I think Dakar would be really fun. I'd like to do the Baja 1000 someday, but I gotta get everything out of my system of the stuff I enjoy now. Yeah. And still chasing titles and stuff like that now. So.
Oh, I can tell when I see you at the race and I see your wife, then you guys are like intense and you want that and it's coming. You'll get it.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, I think last time I saw you may have been backstage Nitro Phoenix. You maybe had Rick Geyser back there with you.
Oh, yeah.
So, immediately I'm going, oh, maybe he's buying a new trophy truck. You never know. So, when are we going to see you in a trophy truck, right?
Oh, I was thinking about it. I'm trying to work it out. I'm just trying to follow Ken's example of how he did it with his race team and develop my race team in the same way. And I Geyser's been helping me, so we'll see. It's coming. I've been working with these guys that run a thing called Driven Experience.
Yeah. I know the guys from Driven.
Yeah. So Andrew's been helping. We're trying to figure something out.
So
I love off-road. So
yeah,
it's not. You don't have to be so technical.
Yeah, there's a little more margin for error,
yes,
right?
Yes, there is. But when you get against guys like, BJ and these guys are going so fast, so hard, and their equipment's good, and they're practicing so much. But it's interesting, I've noticed even in the 1000 this last year, when they break, they don't even really try. They're so done because they're so off the pace. Mm-hmm. My mentality is, run it till it's dead, so.
Yeah, and it's kind of, I had that conversation yesterday, and I know, rally, it's press on regardless, and it's crazy, with Trophy Truck, we were talking about that, you become so far down, and our racing has almost become, stage rally separated by seconds, and we can run a 500-mile race now, and Trophy Truck's been so competitive. I mean, 15, 20 seconds is separating first from second, and that's, that's one pit stop. So our pit stops are becoming more NASCAR style, and it's just become insane the level of competition that that's happened in Trophy Trucks just in the past 5 years.
Yeah, I agree. And there's it the amount of money it takes to compete at that level. There's people that aren't, but there's people that are spending the millions and millions. And so you come in with a team, and I watch Ken and Travis do this in the rally. They kind of brought in a whole nother thought of thinking and sponsors and notoriety, and obviously what Ken's done with Gymkhana. I mean, it really does need to happen in off road to. Not just to get the fans aware of what the hell's going on out there. So people don't understand what is happening and how tight that racing is and how gnarly it is. I mean, I've done it a couple times, but when you're side by side in a trophy truck through a section of whoops coming into San Felipe, I'm not sure there's anything to me more exhilarating, because you're busting through those things at 100 plus and it's like running on ice. You got another truck next to you trying to take you out. It's pretty awesome.
Well, and what's funny is you watch the GoPro of that, and people don't realize you get out of the truck and go and stand, and I mean those whoops are literally as tall as this table,
they're deep,
and that's what's amazing. And I think the same thing with stage rally. I mean, you guys got GoPros on the cars, but until you're actually in a car going through the woods, you don't realize how close you guys are coming to, basically you're skirting disaster at every corner.
Yeah, I tell people it's one thing to see something on video, and then it's a whole other experience to see it standing on the side of a road, and to see those whoops or see like a stage rally road through a forest and how close the trees are. But it's a whole other experience to get inside the car. Really, the things that you know, like off-road truck drivers are able to do with those trucks, or even what we're able to do with a rally car, you know, we're going at the edge of grip, you know, uh-huh. finding that absolute edge and going as fast as you possibly can. And you can't really experience that from video or staying outside the road. You really have to be inside the car to really experience what that's really like. So it's cool for me always to try and give people ride-alongs whenever we do testing and events and stuff like that from, you know, media or VIPs or sponsors and stuff like that. But I mean, don't you agree? Like, it's just so different.
Well, in the stage rally, you know, the thing that shocked me is I just, you guys coming into those corners blind, like as fast as they do with somebody yelling some call in your ear,
yeah.
whatever 5925, whatever it is. But I did experience that once or twice of trying to push. That part of your sport, I think it's insane. Mm. And you're not just on the edge of grip, but it's coming into something blind and the trusting your co-driver. I mean, that is really kind of a unique element in motorsports. There's just nothing that exists that's that difficult. And I couldn't trust a guy that much. I don't, you know, it was interesting when you guys were learning, Travis would always, we'd have these discussions about it. And he says, there's not a faster driver on the track than Ken. Hmm. And he goes, he's just got to learn to keep track on the car on the track. And we had a lot of footage of you going off the track and that co-driver. But, you know, Travis was all those years of experience of racing moto. He kind of had a little bit of an edge on some of that stuff. But he had a problem, too. You know, he had a great co-driver, and but you guys have figured it out and done so well with it. Mm-hmm. But it is. You gotta get out there and get in the truck. There's nothing. You wish you could help people. As a filmmaker, I love to try and figure out better ways to put the audience in the car. I don't think you can do it any better than you've done it, but you, I don't know, smell, your vibration. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, it'll be interesting in the future to see how they try and bring more senses into it. I've driven in a million-dollar Formula One simulator. I spent 4 hours in it. And, it, you know, they give you all the sense of braking and with hydraulics and everything, you know. But at the end of the day, though, it's still a video game. You can never simulate grip.
Yeah.
That's the one thing. You know, I was basically doing laps around the Monza track, you know, the Monza Formula One track, and it became just a memorization exercise, where to brake, where to shift, all that sort of thing, which is what you generally do anyway in a race car. But, you know, at a certain point, you can't sense grip in a video game. You just never will.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting in the long run to see if what sort of things they can bring into video games and experiences like that, or even video, if we can somehow bring more dynamic feels into experiencing video. Who knows what's in the future, but, you know, we've seen a lot of technology, you know, develop over the last 20 years, you know. And so it'll be interesting in the next 20 years what's going to be possible.
Yeah.
Well, it's just, well, just in the past few, because I remember I built my trophy truck originally in 06, and it's gone through a couple of revisions. When we built it in 06, the camera system's there. We were designing the truck. Where can we fit this huge box?
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? It was literally, it was like that. You know, now it's so easy. You know, you've got a double-sided sticky with a GoPro, and you can stick them anywhere on the truck. But, you know, just in less than 10 years, the camera technology that we're able to do, you're not having to mount, you know, a massive, you know, it's just crazy the experiences you can give people, you know, with the technology that's out there now.
You know, the best thing that, along these lines is, and you know this from Robbie Gordon, he's the best I've ever seen at it. So we'd do a couple of things with Robbie, and he would send his plane over and get whoever's sponsor was and bring them out. And they're like, yeah, we'll be involved with racing, so on, blah, blah. Land in San Felipe, and then they'd jump in the car, and they'd be with him for 2 days. And those people's lives were transformed because the speed and how gnarly it is just to be in the car. When you're not driving, it's just to be a passenger. So maybe it's an evolution. You see the video, you get in the car, and then somehow you get into the driver's seat. You can't replicate it. No. There's no way.
Well, and it's me. I mean, I've driven trophy trucks. I've driven some GRC Lights cars. I've, you know, ridden in supercars. You know, I rode in a drift car with Turk at SEMA, you know, but Robbie took me out for Dakar testing with his Gordini, you know, because he comes out to
Parker. Well, you took your life in your hands.
And, you know, get this. Robbie shows up to test his Dakar vehicle. in a t-shirt, shorts, flip-flops, and no helmet. And I'm like, are you serious? And he's like, I don't wreck. And I'm like, I'm putting my helmet on, buddy. But we go out and test, and the way he was backing that thing into corners and stuff, and I've been into corners hard, but those Dakar vehicles, the way they're designed, I mean, it's apples to oranges to anything else, but I think it's just remarkable what you're able to do in drift cars, rally cars, I mean, everything.
They're all different. I, you know, it's the first time I was in a Pro 2 and I'm trying to back that thing into a corner, that was quite the experience. Yeah. It's up like, grabbing on wheels. But, yeah, all of it jumps around. Getting these cars with these guys, I mean, that car Cam's driving is pushing 800 horsepower. How much does that thing weigh?
It's around 3,000 pounds.
Yeah, it's nothing with that kind of weight. I mean, what you can do with it and play with it, and you've shown it. But yeah. The trophy truck's a little heavier, but it's got the same motor in it.
Well, and you wonder, you know, just with rally cars, I mean, how far the progression's come, and you look at, you know, what are they going to look like 10 years from now? You know, and what technology is going to be, and how fast are you going to be able to go?
Well, the thing about, like, a lot of these sports, though, and I know it's, trucks is slightly different because there aren't as many restrictions, but the technology has actually advanced so far that they've actually forced a lot of it out of the sport because it just gets so expensive.
Yeah.
You know, we used to have paddle shift and programmable electronic differentials and all this stuff, and they've taken it all out. The dynamics of the way the car handles continues to improve, but they actually have been pulling technology out to make it more affordable. The World Rally car that I drove in 2010, which was the last iteration of that spec, was a $1 million car. It was a Ford Focus. The next year, 2011, they brought in a new spec, which is when the Fiesta started, and it cut the price in half. It was $500,000.
Yeah.
But still, it's $500,000 for a race car.
Yeah.
It's quite expensive.
To go beat it up in the woods.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I think the McRae car they've got sitting at Dirtfish, it was like that. I mean, it's got a little joystick up there, and it's just little teeny movements.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it and that was how you shifted it. You know, now it's, you know, you've actually got a shift with the sequential box.
Yeah. And the funny thing is they're actually going back to paddle shifts, I think, next year in the WRC. Yeah. One of the initial thoughts was they wanted to see more movement inside, like on camera. Mm. But for whatever reason, they're going back to the paddle shift. I think they've got some new technology that's made it cheaper again, but we'll see. But anyway, it's funny how it evolves. And, like, Formula One keeps just changing the rules to keep challenging people because they have the money to. But in sports like WRC and stage rally in general, and even rallycross, they keep things very simple to keep the cost down, but also to keep it easier to catch people that are trying to cheat. You know, if things are really simple, there's not all these sensors all over the place. All of a sudden, there's a wire going over here. They're like, what's that?
Yeah,
that's not supposed to be there, you know? So, it's real interesting to see that stuff. And
have you guys always had – this is probably a stupid question, but have you guys always had steering brakes? You haven't, had you?
No, we don't. You know, the only thing that we have is the handbrake, and it really is only for hairpins, basically. I use it for drifting, like with the Gymkhana videos.
Yeah.
But really, you only use the handbrake on a tight corner where the radius of what you need to turn – is sharper than what the actual steering angle
kick the
will.
Car, yeah.
Yeah. So, but I know that in off-road, and I've driven buggies before that have had.
It's like sand cars have.
Yeah, these are the two handbrakes. Yeah. You can independently lock up a different rear wheel. So, but yeah, I've never seen that actually in any other vehicle besides like a sand rail.
So that's just emergency brake what you're hitting, because I didn't know.
Yeah, well, with the all-wheel drive system, basically when you pull the handbrake, there's a center diff with a clutch in it, so it releases the drive to the rear wheels. You could actually still drive the front wheels with the gas, but when I pull the handbrake, the center clutch basically engages, so the drivetrain is not going to the back wheels, and then the rear brakes get locked up to lock up the rear wheels. So that's basically, it's got, you know, two lines coming off that handbrake, one that goes to the center diff and one that goes to the rear brakes.
Oh, I was wondering that because I started seeing it poking up there and you're hitting it a lot, and obviously it's throwing you, but I didn't know. Yeah.
Yeah. I know like in our truck, it's like you said, it's an e-brake. Like I've got one in mine and it just locks up both rears at the same time. So you kind of lean it into a corner and then grab it and it'll whip the rear end around.
I've never even driven a trophy truck with it.
Yeah. So there's only a couple of us, me, BJ, and I think maybe Vidosla. There's only a few of us that actually use them, but once you have it in there and we get into some of those mountain roads, you know, and it's twisting and there's some where you've actually got a 3-point corner. It's nice. Cause I mean, everybody else is having a 3-point, and you can grab it and whip it around. And more and more kind of go into it. And I think BJ's might be a little different. I've heard of some guys actually run it off the front wheels. So you can either hook up the left or the right, but you grab it and it'll drag like the left front. Mm. And you give it gas and then the rest of the car will come around. Mm. So it's, I don't know, it's all kinds of different theories and thoughts. And
So you also have to clutch when you pull the handbrake too, right?
Well, we're automatics.
Oh, you're automatics.
Yeah, we're what are we? Manually shifted automatics,
straight.
I guess.
Okay, yeah. I gotcha.
Pretty easy to drive, except you got to just keep it on the wheels as well.
Yeah, that might be my problem.
I think you'd be just. It feels like a moto.
Yeah.
Just it's the same thing. It's just you get it up on top of the whoops. And
yeah. The fun thing for me, though, I did the 1,000 once, just a couple hundred miles of it with Ryan Capes as my guy sitting next to me. Who, by the way, when we switched after like a couple hundred miles, he rolled us within 6 miles of him driving.
He's the motorcycle guy. What do you
anyway,
expect?
Yeah. But he's the one that went out and did testing and everything, and I didn't get to do anything because I was sick. But the thing is, like, I really enjoy it because I enjoy the road reading part of it, like, because that's what I do coming from stage rally is having to identify roads, you know, but also being able to place the car, like, where you need it after you've read the road and or you've heard from, you know, your co-driver what's coming up. I really enjoy that part of it. Like, it's...
I think you'd like it.
Yeah, someday.
That's his retirement job, right?
Yeah. Well, the one time I did it, I enjoyed it. I didn't get any time in that buggy beforehand. I just showed up. I'd gotten food poisoning, so I literally showed up and went straight into the car on the starting line, and we started like 16th on the road behind all the other wide open cars, and I just kind of figured it out. And a lot of people down there, they drive kind of like the moto way, like go in and hit the berms and then go. Like, that's slow. So yeah, I basically took the more momentum style.
Yeah, you're right. They're not road racers. They're not.
So, but I
they're not that sophisticated.
I passed like all 16 of the other wide opens within like 80 miles. It was pretty fun.
Off the start?
Yeah. That was pretty fun.
It is, yeah. It's different. You know, the dust is a little. Well, you guys.
The dust is gnarly. Yeah. Like, ramming people to get them out of your way is gnarly.
The booby traps are a little interesting, too. Yeah. And the people standing in the middle of the road, and the horses, and, you know, people come the wrong direction. It all makes it quite compelling.
Generally, like stage rally, though, if you see a huge group of people, you know, there's a massive jump, right? Same thing in Mexico. If you see a huge group of people, you know, you better slow down because there's something buried or a hole or, you know, you literally, you have to read the people when you're racing in Mexico.
I bet.
Rick Johnson gave me the best advice I ever had when we first started racing down there. And he said, they'll come in on the car or a bike or whatever you're on. And he goes, what you do is you swerve at them. So you really actually aim for the people. He goes, and then you get them out of the way. Or a bike, you just come in and you're like, you know, you hold it wide open. And otherwise, they'll kind of swarm you and try and touch you. And they do. But boy, when you swerve at them, they move quick. I did. The one year we did race trophy down there, I didn't make it too far, but we came through the first section. I hadn't driven the truck much. And on the pavement, and I was like full on wobbling. And I just saw people clearing out. They were running for their lives. Coming at them at 80 miles an hour. So,
how funny.
Yeah.
So, Greg, what are you doing nowadays?
Oh, I am reinventing producing and directing. So.
Oh, okay. Like working on other projects?
Yeah, yeah. We've developed a show in my family called The Godfrey Clan. It's more of it's character development. It's not just stunts. I don't know. What more we can do after the movie? I'm kind of like, you know, I don't know what more we can do without killing somebody. So I want to just build characters and tell stories better. And we've developed some other stuff with Disney. And I've got another show that I'm doing. And, it's been good. It's been really good. Helping out with Nitro a little bit.
So when does this stuff come out?
Godfrey Clan will probably hit the air in around March.
Hmm. Okay.
So, already filmed?
No. Nope. Well, part of it. We got a teaser. I'll show it to you. Mm.
So is that going to be online, or is that what you're doing with Disney?
No, Disney's another thing. It's okay. A theatrical. We're doing a narrative theatrical film with them. My background is I'm a filmmaker. I just was always – I loved racing, loved motorcycles, and kind of drifted into that, tied in with Travis. And, yeah, I've just been trying to follow Ken's lead for the last 10 years. He's a marketing genius. But I don't really like business, so to speak. I don't really like marketing. I just like telling stories. So. But one thing leads to another, you know, and it's just these crazy doors that get opened as you start pursuing. And it's been fun. It's been fun. So Travis is trying to kill off all of my offspring now.
Yeah.
I tried to kill him off for years, and now he's trying to kill off all my offspring. So.
Yeah. So you're still involved with the live shows at all and stuff? Yeah. Yeah. So are you going to New Zealand? Because that kicks off, what, 1st of January?
Yeah, I'm not going. I've got too many things going on here that we're doing. And it's just, honestly, when you do, because you're not competing in the live show, it's great and everything. But when you're not competing, it gets kind of dull. Yeah. You know, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, you've never been like like a freestyle moto guy. You've not been that. You've been much more of a competitor and done stuff for fun. When you or Jeremy get forced to do something.
True. Yeah. I broke my pelvis in Australia 2 years ago, man. That slowed me way down.
Oh, I'm sure.
That was a rough one.
I can't even imagine.
Yeah, that had to have been.
How did you do that?
Going through a loop on a big wheel.
Oh, yeah.
Bob Burnquist warned me. He says, you know, this is what claimed Tony Hawk. This is what slowed him down. I said, oh, I'll be fine. My son whipped around it, and all of a sudden, I flew out the top, and 18 feet straight to concrete. Mm. So I was a mess. Yeah, but things are good, you know. It's we're here in Utah and staying here, snowboarding. Hopefully, we're going to ride a little bit this year. You can be around.
Hopefully.
If we get any snow.
Hopefully.
Yeah. What do you got going on?
I don't know yet.
Really? You don't know what you're going to race?
I mean, I'm going to be doing rallycross again, but it's just all the other stuff around that we're still trying to work out a schedule.
Yeah.
So I got lots of requests from lots of different things around the world, but we're just trying to figure out how they all fit together, which is the fun time that we get to do this time every year. So hopefully we'll have that figured out and have a schedule announced in January. So, but it still looks like my winter is going to be quite fun, though. Hopefully, I'll be here a bit more.
Spend some time with the kids.
Yeah, and hopefully it snows. It's not snowed enough this year so far.
Oh, it'll come.
Another new livery for next year, too, I'm assuming, right?
Yep. New liveries, new projects, new events.
Never ends, right?
No, it doesn't. Unfortunately, I have still too many desires to go do too many silly things around the world, so... It's a good problem, though, right?
Yeah, it is a good problem. It's a good problem, and then I guess until you know, it's like with Nitro. I just kind of feel like, you know, it's time for me to kind of open another chapter. Mm-hmm. When you feel that, you feel that. When you're ready, you know, and you're not there yet, so.
Yep, I am very lucky to be doing what I'm doing, and I'm going to do it as long as I can.
Yeah.
So, until I actually, you know, get tired of it, or if I just... stop being competitive, then I will go a different direction.
I got to kind of back this off a little bit because I have to admit, when he was first at DC and he's telling me he's going to race cars, I didn't know him that well. And I was trying to, I was actually trying to get him on the off-road stuff because I wanted him to pay for the truck. And Travis is like, and then Aspen gets in the middle of it and he says, Greg, stay away from Ken. I'm like, okay. He kept telling me, he goes, I think I'm going to go race rally cars. I'm like, why are you going to race rally cars? And Travis is like, I'm a race, you know, and Travis was starting to do it. But, man, you've done, you know, you continually, you know, the thing about you and I that I enjoy is we dream a lot. And we have the capacity to kind of turn those dreams into, I mean, I look at what you've done in the automotive industry. I was down at SEMA and literally he knew jack squat about cars, at least from what I knew when you first started. Not like. But all of a sudden, he owns that place. You know, he and BJ, it was like you guys were everywhere. And with Hoonigan and everything, you've done it extremely. Here you go into a different market. It reminds me a little bit. And here, I'm not trying to give brownie points because I really don't give a shit. I really don't. But I'm just being honest. But it reminds me of the Oakley guy. You know, how he kind of redefined sunglasses and then he moves into cameras. And all of a sudden, I mean, what are you going to do with cameras? and he, with the red and that, and then he kills it. And Ken's done the same thing with what he did with Action Sports, and then he moves in, and it's pretty impressive.
Well, thank you. It didn't.
You're still a douchebag. But.
Oh, thanks, Greg. So are you. It didn't actually come from anywhere. I mean, I grew up loving rally, and because of my sort of industrial design background, I've studied car design since I was a kid. So that's not stuff that you would know, though.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, but I mean, that's just been my interest since I was very young. And then I've always paid attention to racing, especially rally racing. But if most people, even my close friends, didn't know that. But yeah, it's just, it's always been there. So when I got into what I'm doing now, it was very natural and easy for me because it was all already there. And then I just kind of turned on my marketing side of brain once I got good at the racing, and then that all came about too. So it's been very fun. Thank you, Greg.
Yeah, you will.
I know it's tough to give other people
a compliment. Oh, it's so hard.
So wait, does the show, the new show, have a home yet?
Maybe.
Okay.
not allowed to disclose yet, right?
Yeah, I can't. I'm right in the middle of it, actually. Yeah, it's pretty fun. There's a guy we're working with that it's actually part of Casey's deal. It's Billy Gerber.
Oh, yeah.
So he and Casey are really good friends, and that's been fun. Mm. Casey's been awesome.
Those deals are not easy. I've dealt with several of them.
Yeah, but I'm used to it, you know, and I like it. And
good.
I just like developing. And these movies are just, like, it's so different for us to just worry about story. Mm. You know, usually I'm like, okay, what is the biggest massive stunt we can possibly do? But it's not about that. It's just more about how the story's going to develop and go forward. The stunts are part of it, no question. But it's not the end.
I have a question for you.
Oh, this ought to be good.
Who knew the good spots like at Lake Powell to go jump off all that stuff?
Who do you think?
So it was you.
This is my town, man. this is pretty funny. He's never been down there.
Yeah.
And he's like, we were just going down, my wife and I, and he's like, I don't even know how somehow we were texting, and I said, let's hook up. And he's kind of tripping out because I just found him in some canyon. He's like, how in the hell? It's my lake, bro. And he's like, where's a good cliff to jump off? And I said, well, I don't know, look around. There's hundreds.
I got to ask, you guys both got Mastercraft boats, obviously. You know, and I know you're wearing the Mastercraft hat right now. I mean, wakeboarding, I mean, you got to be involved in something, right? You can do anything nutty?
With wakeboarding?
Wakeboarding. I mean, what are you, inner tubes off ski jumps? I mean, what do we got going on here, Greg?
I just always love boats and water. I mean, anything. I mean, it's invention, right? Wakeboarding is kind of, I'm not a very good wakeboarder, but yeah, like we do some stuff. My kids, it's not me anymore, though. It's my kids. Yeah. They're taking the reins. And
they're cutting you a little slack, right?
Thank goodness. But yeah, it's anything with a boat. Mastercraft, we've been working with them a ton in the last year, and those guys are fantastic company. So I'm, in fact, that's why we had them up here doing a thing, and this is typical Greg, but I'm like, oh yeah, Ken's shop's over here. And they're like, really? And I said, yeah. And they go, should we just barge in? And I said, yeah, it's fine. We come in, we're rolling around. And seriously, man, if I could have gotten that car, I would have taken it for a burn or two.
I'm so glad the keys are locked away.
But I think anything, as long as it's adventurous and cool, whether it's airplanes, helicopters, race cars, I mean, it's all good. In machines, it's just whatever, exploring the world and going to the ends of the earth, it's all good. So
who's a bigger instigator? Is it you or Travis?
I don't know. He's got more pull for sure. But I got my ways. You've been around.
Yeah. But you haven't pushed me to do anything too stupid, but Travis is... He is the world's best instigator that I have ever seen.
Yeah, I think I'm. I think
I don't
right
understand
there.
How he gets people to do the things that they do. I mean, the one thing he did to me that worked quite well is he just said, "If you don't do this, you're a pussy." And of course, no one wants to be called a pussy. So he made me do some stupid stuff. But man, I can't. I didn't really experience the full breadth of what Travis's skills of instigation until I went to his house.
Yeah.
And he just has so many things lined up to throw people off of.
For the most part, it's pretty safe.
Yeah. Fairly.
That's I mean, you could get hurt, but.
That's what I hear. You go there, and you have no idea what you're going to come out doing. It's just, you know, there's something about that place that I don't want to call it mystical or what, but you end up doing stuff that, you know, you never would have thought possible. So
there's a lot of magic, but there's a lot of horrific events that have happened there. Yeah. Even out at our place, like we were counting the days that we were so lucky. But the last one was, do you know Trevor Jacobs? Mm. So Trevor's pretty amazing, an athlete. So he comes out there and he's just, his eyes are wide. He's willing to do anything. Like somebody, like you're going out there and you're going to say, all right, there's a limit, but I want to push myself. And I think that's how people come into it. And Travis plays with it, and I play with it. But Trevor's sitting there eyeing that big ramp, you know, into the airbag. You know which one I'm talking about, the triple backflip one? And he's a pretty good rider, but he's a snowboarder by trade. And he's like, can I hit it, Greg? Can I hit it? And I said, go get your gear on. It wasn't any instigation, you know. Yeah. It was just giving him the opportunity. So he comes at it, and he hits that thing. Did you remember the footage of that? He kind of goes off the ramp, and he's like 60, 70 feet in the air.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah.
Taps the tree.
Oh, yeah, hits the tree. Yes.
You know, but he has such air awareness. And that's like my kids. They're used to flipping and tossing whatever. But it was like that was a moment that just could have been
really
unbelievably bad.
Yeah.
And so Colin's crash out there was unbelievably bad. Tommy's crash was unbelievably bad. Yeah. The guy landing on the Bombcat was unbelievably bad. There's been some moments, but, you know, I think everybody wants to. And he gives them the opportunity. I think I'm a little more cautious. If I need a shot, I'll push him. Like in the 3D movie, with when we did the slingshot, you know, into the pyramid. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. And Roner, Jeremy's like, we're gonna kill somebody, and Roner's like, I don't know if I can do it again. And I says, we need two more shots. You got to stand. Either you don't do it, or somebody needs to do it. You need to stand up because we didn't finish the process. So it goes back and forth. I think I'm not quite as playful about it. Get a little more serious because we need something. So long answer.
Yeah.
So do you do that to your own kids?
Oh, yeah.
But what age did you start doing that to them?
Oh, since they're born.
Oh, okay, I mean, okay.
I got to ask.
It's our family.
That's what I was wondering. Am I being a bad dad?
I got to say that.
You need to push them, man.
When you guys get medical insurance or life insurance, I mean, they got to ask a lot of questions, right?
Oh, man. I don't know what you've gone through, but.
Well, my kids are still young.
No, I mean just with you personally.
Yeah.
I mean, they start finding out what you do, and they send you these amendments and
it's amendment upon amendment, and dates and times and when you're going to do what, and it's pretty nutty.
Yeah.
Hey, is Tremaine a good instigator?
Yeah, but Jeff doesn't like talk him into gnarly stuff.
Yeah.
He's unbelievable at talking him into doing. He's funny.
Yeah,
you know,
but he's more used to a non-athletic world.
Yeah,
people just doing stupid stuff and jackass. So, but that's why I was wondering how he worked with you guys.
Oh, it was like putting on an old glove. He was all those guys, Knoxville and Tremaine. It was just very easy. They all understand. They really elevated it to a good level.
Yeah.
But Jeff, when we were doing the big stuff, I mean, he would be over in the corner just like terrified. You know, because he wasn't used to it. And he's like, he'd come over and he's like, are we going to kill somebody? I'm like, Jeff, just put something funny in that piece, you know. I'll give you the gnarliness, just put in the funny. He's great.
Yeah. Well, what do they say? Nitro was jackass, but you can die, right?
Yeah.
In the movie, well, it's also the athletic side of jackass.
Kind of. A little bit.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I think jackass is that anybody could do that stuff in a certain, it depends on their level of fear of death, basically, or having really bad things done to them. But Nitro was where you actually really have to physically have skill on a bike or skis or parachute, whatever, to do this stuff, you know?
Think through it. You've got to really think through it to survive it. They're all athletes, though. They've all competed. Yeah.
But to put it into perspective, I mean, I used to ride bikes in contests and, you know what I mean, in BMX freestyle contests all the time. And I've been off a bike I still go out and toy around. But when we were at Nitro, you know, Jolene's like, you can go up the top of the ramp. So I go up there and I look down. I'm like, holy crap. You know what I mean? There was no way I was rolling off of that to hit that. But I mean, it's just you know, you got to have skill to do that. I mean, to hit that ramp and to do the things they're doing. It's just nuts.
Yeah, it's going to catch up to it. You know who invented the mega ramp?
No, not me. Danny.
Well,
I just paid for it.
Okay, well, how's that?
I had to manage Danny and his expectations and the money that it took to do all that.
Yeah, there's such an amazing piece of all this collaboration and all these things that have come together and to be where it is, in all of it, what they're doing with Hennigan and Gymkhana, with Nitro and with the Godfrey Clan, it's freaking awesome. I never thought it would happen like this.
No, but it's also been cool to watch it all come together in the last, I don't know, less than 10 years, really?
It's been 10 years. Yeah. 11 years.
Because, I mean, we put out the DC video with Danny's Mega Rant part in 2004. So, yeah, about 10 years.
Yeah.
But you know, from like Jeff, I watched Jeff go from Big Brother to then Jackass and watch you guys do what you did. And it's been cool to see all this stuff in the past 10 years really come together. You know, before that, skateboarding and snowboarding, all that, and freestyle moto and everything were coming up. But really, the last 10 years is when things have really gone much more mainstream and really gotten much bigger. It's been cool to watch.
Yeah, and it's got to change a little bit. It's like the wakeboarding industry and the freestyle. Something's got to change a little bit. And that's what Travis is trying to do. By killing off everybody doing triple backflips. he damn near killed my nephew out there. They were trying to do quads into an airbag. Did you see the footage of him? He went back and he went back so hard on a BMX bike, he hit the wheel.
Ooh,
and it stopped all his momentum, so he went straight up like 40 feet in the air and came straight down, walked away.
I've not seen that. So he didn't make it to the airbag?
Not even close.
Oh, wow. Oh my gosh.
Shot him straight up because it stopped all his momentum when he hit his butt.
Real forward momentum. It was.
Yeah. Was it the big jump to the big airbag?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. I have not seen that.
I'm going to have to look that up.
Yeah.
It's online.
So
that's in one of the newer action figures?
Yeah, it's one of I think it's the one that's got the bigger views. And then my one nephew was throwing down that double backflip. Did you see that with the big old, I don't even know what you call it, scorpion thing on a mountain bike?
No, yeah, yeah.
It was. You were at the show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You were, and you did you yeah. in Phoenix, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's fun watching them do. Yeah. Jeff's the one that called me, and he said, Greg, he went to the Anaheim show, and he says, what in the hell? Why aren't you doing the show on your family? So he's like, let's put it together. So much remains to be involved in that.
Is he's part of that?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Very good.
All right, guys. Well, we are about 30 minutes left, and I got one more interview, but it's definitely been fun. Appreciate both of you guys taking the time, and I'm sure we could go on for another hour or so just talking.
It's fun, to catch up. It's fun to catch
absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely.
It's easy shit to talk about, too.
Ah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We'll have to do it again soon.
I have to get a picture of my view. Smile, Jim. Easy.
All right.
You grab a photo.
Yeah. All right, we are going to take a short commercial break. When we come back, we will be live with, not live, but to record an interview with Ivan the Iron Man Stewart. So stay tuned to the Down and Dirty Radio Show, lit up by Rigid Industries and schooled by Dirtfish Rally School.
Dirtfish Rally School is the premier rally driving school on the West Coast, located in Snoqualmie, Washington. If you are looking for a ton of fun with world-class driving instructors honing your skills, Dirtfish is the place for you. Dirtfish has 315 acres of playground with mixed surfaces for your driving experience. You can spend anywhere from 2 hours to 3 intense days of instruction refining your driving and racing skills. Whether you are looking for credits towards your Rally America license, honing your racing skills, or just having a fun time, Dirtfish is your school. Your classroom is behind wheel of a 300-horsepower, rally-prepped Subaru STI. These cars have protective cages, suspension modifications, and are built for one purpose, to push you to your limit. By the end of your time at Dirtfish, you will have the confidence to rally with the best. Whether you're looking for a thrilling first-time rally experience or to increase your knowledge and time in the driver's seat, Dirtfish has a driving experience to suit your needs. For any information on their classes, corporate events, or their facility, check them out on the web at www.dirtfish.com or on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Dirtfish Rally. Rigid Industries is the original and number one LED light bar manufacturer in the world. torture tested by some of the best drivers in motorsports. Rigid LED lighting products use cutting-edge technology and can stand up to the harshest conditions Mother Nature can dish out. Designed, engineered, and assembled in the United States, Rigid LED lighting is the only choice for your off-road vehicle or boat. Find out more information on the entire line of Rigid Industries LED lighting products at www.rigidindustries.com. Very few companies can call themselves an industry leader. Racetech Seats is one of the few. It doesn't matter if you race off-road, rally, touring cars, sprint cars, drag racing, or boats. Chances are, Racetech Seats have a seat that will keep you safe, secure, and comfortable, allowing you to concentrate on winning. Racetech Seats meet and exceed the FIA crash test standard, are HANS compatible, flame resistant, and offer full containment, meaning you can race knowing you are protected by the best. More information can be found at www.racetech-usa.com. That's www.racetech-usa.com. Racetech Seats. Our passion is keeping you safe. Come to the island and rip it up this summer. Wakeboard Island. It's a skate park on water at Blue Water Resort and Casino. Check out the two-tower cable system that pulls you and your board over the water. No boats to watch out for. No fumes. Wakeboard Island is open to all skill levels with an open center section for beginners. And for trick riders, a double side kicker and a 60-foot flat box. Wakeboard Island. The best ride this side of the Rockies. Adjacent to the River's Edge Cantina at Blue Water Resort and Casino on the Colorado River in Parker, Arizona.
The number one off-road and action motorsports radio show on the planet now has its own app. The Down and Dirty Radio Show official app is now available in the Apple App Store, Google Play Store, and Amazon Kindle Store. Just search Down and Dirty Radio Show, and you'll have all the latest news, results, and blockbuster interviews from off-road, rally, drifting, supercross, and snowcross at your fingertips. Hours of interviews from the best drivers and athletes on earth, such as Travis Pastrana, Ken Block, Tanner Faust, Brian Deegan, Robbie Gordon, and Jolene Van Vuit are yours at the touch of a button. Download today and never miss an interview.
Okay, when you're on the job, you're making tough decisions around the clock. Well, here's an easy one. Ford F-Series. Under the hood, F-Series trucks have the power and fuel efficiency you need. Translation? You can always tackle the toughest jobs without losing a fortune at the pumps. But it's not just all brawn and no brains. F-Series trucks also have a cutting-edge selection of smart technology that keeps you connected, focused, and informed, all while behind the wheel. That's why, on average, every 42 seconds, someone forks over their hard-earned cash to get a new F-150 or Super Duty. No wonder they're the best-selling brand of trucks in America for 37 years in a row. The competition never stood a chance. Ford F-150, Ford Super Duty. Number one for 37 years straight. Not convinced? Get behind the wheel of an F-150 or Super Duty and decide for yourself. Go online to your local Ford dealers.
Don't miss your chance to unwrap $10,000 cash, plus iPods, iPads, Xbox One, HDTVs, and more. With Santa's Gift Madness at Blue Water Resort and Casino. Come play for your chance at over $50,000 in cash and prizes. Weekly drawings are Wednesday nights and Sunday afternoons through December 21st. Then on December 28th at 5 p.m., the huge $10,000 cash drawing. The more you play, the better your odds of winning $50,000 in cash and prizes. Santa's Gift Madness. See the club for details. And happy holidays from Blue Water Resort and Casino on the Colorado River in Parker, Arizona.
Welcome back to the Down and Dirty Radio Show, lit up by Rigid Industries and schooled by Dirtfish Rally School. I'm your host, Jim Beaver. Man, it's been a fun show so far. Year number three. Ken Block. We've had Greg Godfrey from Nitro Circus in-house, and Aaron All here live from Hoonigan Racing. Right now, before we end the show, we got an interview I did last week with Ivan the Iron Man Stewart. So here's Ivan. All right. I'd like to welcome our next guest to the air, the legend Iron Man Ivan Stewart. How's everything going, Ivan?
Oh, fantastic, Jim. I'm so fortunate to do what I do and still doing it, actually. You know, I've raced for so many years, and I still have a contract with Toyota. It's been over 30 years that I've been contracted to Toyota, so I'm still doing, you know, gosh, it's been 40 years I've been playing off-road and doing off-road functions, you know. So now I'm fantastic. How about you?
You know, everything is good on my end. I gotta say, I know, you know, you approaching, what, next year, 32 years with Toyota. I mean, to me, that's mind-boggling. I mean, you know, not many drivers have ever spent that much time with one manufacturer.
No, we've done some research, and very few. You're right. Richard Petty had many, many years with STP and Dodge, and some other drivers out there. I see Hurley Haywood with Porsche for many years, but I'm right up there with the big boys anyway.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, and I know that relationship, I mean, now, obviously, you know, you're not competing in Trophy Truck. I haven't for quite some time. But, you know, like this, you know, this past Baja 1000, still very much involved with Toyota. You guys went down there and, you know, and finished the Baja 1000 with relatively a stock Toyota. You know, tell us a little bit about that program. I know you got a chance to go out with Jay Leno in that truck, too, right?
Yeah, we were up there about, gosh, it's been probably 3 weeks, a month ago with Jay Leno and Barstow doing some filming for one of his shows. And, yeah, that's the example. That's kind of the example I'm talking about. I'm so fortunate to do these things and to work with these guys. I kind of acted as their coach this year to get four different drivers down to the finish line in the Baja 1000. And, you know, you probably know as well as I do, the biggest problem I had, I'll let you guess at it, what is the biggest problem I had with these four drivers?
I don't know, man. You're putting me on the spot here, but I gotta say, it's probably, you know, just driving over your head. I mean, especially, you know, a lot of them not with a ton of seat time, you can get in trouble in a hurry in Baja.
You're exactly right. I mean, that was my biggest problem, was to convince these guys that when they say the Baja 1000, they don't mean the Baja 1000 race. They mean you've got 1,000 miles of treacherous roads that you have to navigate. So get that race stuff out of your mind and just survive it. You know, if you start making mistakes, you're going too fast. I mean, you know, then the psychological part comes in where people come up and they want to bump you and pass you, and then you have to make a decision. Am I going, you know, going too slow, or are they going too fast? And normally, you know, you've been around the racing long enough to realize that normally the guys that are doing that are going way too fast. They don't have any experience either. So that was the biggest problem we had, is getting the guys to slow down enough not to tear a stock Toyota Tundra.
Yeah, and that's what I thought was amazing. I mean, you know, looking at that truck, I mean, it relatively was a stock Toyota truck, and just speaks for the capabilities of what that thing was able to do.
Yeah, you know, I tell people all the time, you know, and any your listeners that are off-road enthusiasts, if they've been around very long, they'll realize that you can take 100% stock virtually any truck and drive it for many, many, many miles off-road. But you just can't tear it up. You can't overdrive it. You just have to go slow and drive it within your parameters and the truck's parameters. And that's the hard part, is getting that race mode out of people's head where they have to race and go faster, including myself. For years, it took me a long time to realize I won a lot more races by going racing smart opposed to racing fast. You can't be slow, as you know, but still, you have to use your head. If you're sliding off the road, if you're abusing the truck, you're hurting it, you got to slow down. It's that simple.
Yeah, well, and you know, I have some experience in a single seat vehicle, and that's how you made your, you know, basically made your career. But, you know, speak to that point. I mean, a lot of these guys, you know, talking about that. I mean, if you get a flat, a lot of these guys, you know, they had a co-rider to jump out, change the flat for them. I mean, you had to be extra careful, because if you were to get a flat or make a mistake, it's you out there wrenching on the car, it's you fixing the tire.
Well, not only that, Junior, that's a big one. You know, changing that spare tire by yourself, especially nowadays. They're getting heavier and heavier, as you know, bigger in diameter and heavier. But the other part of the equation is all these guys that you pass, you know, going so fast, you have a flat, now you've got to go back and pass them again. So, I mean, one flat tire doesn't sound like much now. And the other biggest part of the equation in this day and age is, if you're in a single seat vehicle, like if you're driving, and I drove for many years, you don't get to use a GPS. So that's a big deficit now, not having that GPS. So between the flat tires, the GPS, and those things, it's you know, that single seat stuff is pretty tough.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I know you had the opportunity, especially with the 500. I mean, you know, living in San Diego, you're just a skip away from where, you know, you actually race. So you were able to get a lot of pre-running in, do your homework. But, I mean, you know, circling back, I mean, you know, say the Baja 500. I mean, you know, what did a month of May look like for Ivan Stewart in preparation for that race? Because there for a while, I mean, you were pretty much unbeatable at the Baja 500.
Yeah, you know, for some reason, I think part of that was psychology, because my birthday was always on, you know, everybody has a birthday the same day. Mine was June the 4th. So, and the race was always around this June the 6th. So I thought that I deserved that race for my birthday present. So that one was always pretty easy for me. And yeah, I could run down there. You know, that's a big benefit, as you were mentioning, being able to run down and be on the race course, and, you know, literally within an hour, I could be down there pre-run the Baja 500.
Yeah, definitely advantage. I mean, you know, let's a lot of the listeners, I mean, you know, a lot of them know of you, but let's go back to the start, because, you know, a lot of everybody knows you from the Toyota days and you know, kind of what you're doing now, and maybe the Mickey Thompson days and PPI. But let's go back to the start. I mean, how did Ivan Stewart get involved in off-road racing? Because it wasn't like you were born into it. You know, you didn't have a silver spoon in hand. I mean, how did you get involved in off-road racing?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've been asked that a lot, and I've given a lot of thought. But as long as I can remember, Jim, I've been competitive. If it be foot racing when I was in elementary school, or go-kart racing, if it was coaster racing, bicycles, it seemed that I was always competitive in what I wanted to do. And I got into ballroom dancing 6 or 8 years ago, and I had to compete at it. So to go down and watch, I had heard about the Baja 500, Baja 1000. To go and watch was that kind of got me hooked, but I had to figure a way to do it. So, you know, I searched out a friend of mine that wanted to build an off-road race car, a two-seat buggy, a guy by the name of Bill Rinko, which I doubt that you remember, your dad would. Bill Rinko, and he wanted to own a race car, and he says I could ride with him if I would help him work on it and prep it and build the engine and that type of stuff. So I rode with him for a few races, and then he broke his leg one day, and it gave me a chance to drive. And that was my golden opportunity to drive. And we won. It was about a 300-mile race. And then with winning, and then next time I won the Ironman Award with driving a Modern Motors single-seat car. And I started building a name and a reputation. And then timing is so important. I happened to be at the right place at the right time with the Ironman name and with a pretty good history of winning races when Toyota came along. So between the passion of competing and, you know, anything that was competitive I wanted to do, and more probably for Baja was the adventure. You know, I wanted to be a part of the adventure of racing the 1000 and driving in daytime and nighttime and, you know, all the hazards and the booby traps and fog and all these things. So for me, it was probably as much the adventure as the race.
Yeah, you know, and you know, talking about that, you know, PPI came, you know, in Toyota, you know, you signed contracts with them, you got involved there, and you know, that was when, you know, pickups were really kind of, Toyota was really, you know, starting to get a foothold in the United States. I mean, you and the PPI program, I mean, you helped build a brand, especially with the Toyota pickups in America. You know, how was that? I mean, and how was what you guys were doing, you know, how did that help develop the trucks? Because we know a lot of the, you know, what you guys were doing on the track was directly related to what actually went in the pickups. And I think that's why they caught on so well in America, was because, you know, the endurance and the quality of the vehicles.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the fact that being at the right place at the right time. And then I kind of realized that, you know, there was a lot of especially with the Mickey Thompson series, there was a lot of manufacturers that wanted to get involved, wanted to win off-road racing. But, you know, I just kind of knew that I'd probably keep a job if I could look like a race car driver and win races and help Toyota win races and championships. And what we did through those years, without really thinking about it at the time, is we really helped establish that Toyota was a very tough and reliable truck. And what happened with building the brand, since we were winning races and championships, Toyota started advertising, and that's doing television commercials and full page ads and magazine ads and everything you could imagine, capitalizing on this winning these maybe Thompson races. Then it went over into doing desert racing also. So, and I just happened to be a part of it. If you think about it, you know, I helped them build their brand, and they certainly helped build my brand. I mean, you know, with the arcade games and items for Signature Series trucks and models and all those things. I mean, Toyota was a huge part of that too, you know.
Yeah, it was definitely a partnership that went both directions, right?
It really was, yeah, and it still is to this day. I mean, they have certain needs, and I have certain needs, and they've been good to each other, and we've been riding the wave for a long time, so we're hoping to continue to ride that wave and benefit the both of us.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the video games. I got to ask you. I know somewhere you've got to have one of these, you know, video game cabinets stuffed. How often do you ever put quarters in and actually play?
That's funny you ask, because I don't. I live in a condominium right downtown San Diego, and I don't have room. But my son Craig has got one in his playroom, so I got there to play it once in a while.
Too funny. I'm sure the grandkids love it too, right?
Yes, they do. They love to play it.
Well, let's talk a little bit. You know, let's move on to trophy trucks, because you know, you raced. You know, basically class one for a while, which, you know, we all know, you know, it was kind of the predecessor, you know, you guys were running trucks there, and Sal created the trophy truck class with, you know, with his vision. So in comes trophy truck. I mean, you know, take us through, you know, the first couple of years in that and the program. I mean, the single seat, because that's really, you know, in my opinion, you know, early 90s, you know, when you really started to take off into kind of mainstream, and that's when the program really, you know, started hitting its stride.
It really did, but you know, it was really the only reason Toyota got involved originally is because of Mickey Thompson and Stadium Racing. And Cal Wells is, and I don't know if you ever met Cal Wells, but he was a great guy to drive for, you know, very dedicated and you know, just fantastic car owner. He convinced Toyota at the time, as long as they had this shop over building Stadium Racing trucks, let's go ahead and build desert racing trucks too, and they could do it relatively economical. So they built the first truck, if you remember, was a Class 7, which we did. We ran very successfully, and I didn't really, you know, I mean, it was, I wanted to go Class 1, and about that time, as you mentioned, Sal came out with trophy trucks, so that was great for me. And I think probably because of liability, Cal Wells and Toyota decided to go with a single-seat truck, so they wouldn't have the liability of carrying a passenger and accidents and all those type of things. You know, and if I did it, I mean, I loved doing it. It was probably the best equipment you could drive at the time. But with hindsight, there was a lot of times I wish I had a passenger with me, especially when I had a flat. Or if I wanted to, you know, if I was getting lost or something, I wanted somebody to help me get out of this situation. Or if you got hurt, you know, you'd have somebody to help you. But it hasn't worked out. It was a great, fantastic part of my life, my racing career. And again, I still get to go out and drive them. I drove that V8 powered truck a few months ago with some NASCAR guys, actually, and did some filming and what have you. But no, it was a great part of my life. I mean, I wouldn't change a bit of my racing career.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that last V8 truck, because I know, you know, it's still out there. You know, you were able to actually drive it. And I know, you know, a lot of talk on social media and the internet's, you know, it's all the bench racers want to know, you know, how was that truck? You know what I mean? And could it still compete today? And I mean, I want to hear straight from you. I mean, how was it to drive that truck? And do you think, I mean, you know, if you could bring back the PPI program from 2000 to today with you in there and give you a year or so to redevelop the truck, do you think you could still go out and win the Baja 500?
Yeah, I do. I like to think that, yeah. But it would take a lot of, you know, a lot of developing. But the biggest thing that's happening now is from the days I was driving, you know, the tires have gotten so much bigger.
Yeah.
So with that, you've got to have more suspension, bigger drivetrain, bigger horsepower, you know, to carry that, you know, draft shafts and axles and CV joints and all those things have got to be developed so much bigger. So the truck that I drove, to bring it out, even though it's probably got enough horsepower, and you could bring the horsepower up more, you could go one of the, as far as that goes, in trophy trucks, we could Toyota NASCAR motor in there to be plenty of horsepower. But you still got to develop the drivetrain. And I would think if I really wanted to do it, but I, again, doing it and having a real passion is a big, big difference. You know, to just go out and say, yeah, I want to go off-road racing, well, that's fine. But if you have a passion to really get in shape, practice, and, you know, and test and pre-run and all those things, that takes a whole lot, probably more than what I want to do right now. That's one of the reasons that I tell people, it's just, you know, I'm not passionate about it anymore. I really enjoy it. I love to go watch the races and have a great time with it, but I don't have a passion to drive. So that's probably the biggest difference for me.
Yeah, and I remember the race. You debuted the V8, and obviously you had a bunch of wins with the V6s. You guys went to the V8, and you know, how was that for? I mean, it was like, you know, putting that truck on steroids almost. I mean, you were just shot out of a cannon that day. You know, how was that for the program? It seemed just. I mean, I remember it was like, when's Ivan going to get a V8? When's Ivan going to get a V8? You showed up, you had it, and you just went out and dominated.
Yeah, we had a lot of. You remember a lot of. You know, developing prior to that with the V6, as you say, and even the four-cylinder prior to that with the Class 7 truck. But no, I watched, you know, I've been around since 1983, which was all when I first started racing, they didn't even have a V6. So, I mean, I went through a V4, developed that for a long time, and the V6 for ages, we raced the V6, and then to finally get the V8, I mean, that was like a dream come true. Now we really had some horsepower to play with, you know, so... We never really had any problem with horsepower. It was always probably tuning it down or tuning me down with to drive the truck within, you know, the drivetrain was the biggest thing because, you know, in off-road racing, opposed to any other form of racing, it's an all-day crash. So how high you jump and how hard you jerk the drivetrain is typically how far you're going to go in the race and how successful you're going to be. So learning to drive the truck within its parameters again, you know, not tearing the drivetrain up, that's probably the biggest thing. The engine was typically never a problem. I mean, the engines were always fantastic. Normally there was something else that would, you know, driver would tear tires off it or tear the suspension up or overheat the shocks or something. But it was a great time, and it was fun to develop those things and be a part of it and to win races. And, you know, I tell people all the time that I've got memories that I wouldn't trade $1 million for. You know, it's great friends and fun I've had over the years.
Yeah. I got to ask you one question, and then we'll kind of move on with some of these questions. But, you know, one of the iconic things about you that everybody recognizes is even when everybody else, you know, went to full-face helmets and pumpers and everything else, I mean, you really stuck with the open-face helmet. What was the reasoning behind that?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, it's you know, they first started developing the Parker Pumper when I was racing, and it seemed like I tried it two or three times, and every time it would either leak or fogged up or it was hot in there, and I always seemed like I had a problem with it. And I remember taking one of them and throwing it as far as I could. I thought, you know, I'm like, guys on motorcycle racing, they only use a full face helmet, and I figured if I got out in front, I wouldn't have the dust. And that's basically what I did. The biggest problem I had was passing guys. You start passing Kobe trucks with, you know, 600-700 horsepower, they start throwing rocks at you, big rocks. So I had a little slide-up window right above the steering wheel, the single seaters that I drove, that I could kind of pull that up a little bit and hide behind it when I was passing those guys. But that was the biggest thing for me. It wasn't the dust as much as the, because typically when you pass people, if you can catch them where they're not making dust or going downhill is a secret. You don't want to follow somebody in the dust all the time and be eating the dust anyway. So I just kind of waited until I knew I could pass them where they wouldn't make a lot of dust. So anyway, I had a lot of little secrets like that to drive without gloves and a full face helmet. Get out front, you need all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I guess that's the moral of the story, right? Yeah. If you're leading the race, you don't need to worry about it.
that was my theory.
Yeah,
it didn't always work.
Well, kind of talk about. I know you've got some stuff now. I mean, you're involved with a lot of things. Obviously, doing a lot of ballroom dancing. You still make a lot of appearance for Toyota. I know. I know you're really into goal setting. Kind of talk a little bit about that because I know it's kind of a platform of yours almost.
Well, yeah, I think I believe in setting goals and. You know, little goals, and I have done it my whole life, and I did it my early years, and even the construction company not really realizing what I was doing. But yeah, goal setting extremely important because once you reach a goal, a small goal, that gives you the confidence to reach the next goal, and that gives you confidence to set the next goal to reach the next goal, and pretty soon you're reaching the big goal. So yeah, it's a shame that a lot of people don't know how to do that. But yeah, I mean, if they go out and set goals too big, then they get disappointed and they lose the confidence to go out and set another goal. So it's a matter of setting little ones, reaching them, building the confidence, and just moving on. So yeah, I'm a big proponent of setting goals.
Yeah. Well, and I got to ask you, too. I mean, we touched on it briefly, but I know everybody knows by now. I mean, you've been very competitive in ballroom dancing. I mean, how did that come about? How did you get involved? I know you're very competitive. How often are you competing in that now?
Well, I'm not competing anymore, but we did for, I guess, 5 or 6 years. Well, my wife and some neighbors, when I was living out in the East County in San Diego, wanted to take dancing lessons. And I always, in the back of my mind, I always wanted to, I think probably a lot of guys would like to know how to dance. They don't want to learn. Yeah. I don't want to embarrass themselves. So anyway, one of the neighbors mentioned going taking lessons, and we went for about 5 or 6 weeks, and it was filling around until my instructor said that, you know, that Ivan, you know, you can compete in ballroom dancing if you want to. So as soon as she said that, then that kind of really perked my ears up. And if you commit to something, you know, the last thing you want to do is the last place, you know, last place in the contest, if it's racing or dancing. So I went out and practiced like crazy, and before long I was winning trophies and small little things, you know, traveling around doing it. But we don't do it anymore. But it was another fun part of my life.
Yeah. And how is that for fitness? I mean, because you've always been one that's always working out and fitness. I mean, I've heard, but I mean, ballroom dancing has got to be pretty darn good for your cardio, right?
It really is. And you'd be surprised. You get out there you said ballroom dancing or barroom dancing? Because I did barroom dancing, not ballroom. No, I'm kidding about that. But yeah, you get out there and you can get winded. I mean, you get out there and start moving around, try it sometime for 3 or 4 minutes, and it's pretty good cardio.
Yeah.
Cardio.
Well, so if Dancing with the Stars called, is Ivan Stewart on board?
I'm sorry?
I said if Dancing with the Stars calls, is Ivan Stewart on board with going on TV and dancing?
Yeah, I don't know. I learned to never say never.
That's for sure.
I think you'd have to be a bunch of your name than myself.
Yeah. Well, as we kind of wind this down, I mean, you know, you've got so many accomplishments. I mean, Baja 500s, Baja 1000 victories. You know, anything that you know sticks out in your mind is one of your favorite moments.
I, you know. Right now, just to jump up with something that, you know, I think whenever Brian, my son Brian and I raced the Baja 1000 one year, and, no, I'm sorry, not the Baja 1000, but the Mint 400. We were both on the podium at the same time. That was when Brian, my son, was driving for Walker Evans. That was pretty special to do that, you know, and then have my son Craig has got his business out there, Stewart Raceworks in El Cajon. He builds beautiful trophy trucks and pre-rugs and that type of stuff, and you know, watch him be successful, and I've got a house down in Baja now that we go down to. In fact, we're probably going to go down for Christmas and have the family down. So, you know, just my life is such a dream, and I jump on my motorcycle and take long motorcycle rides, and my whole family's got our health, and I've got my health, and I get you calling me wanting to do a radio interview, which I love to do, and talk about my history and career and fun I've had over the years. So, I mean, I live a dream life. I'm thankful for every minute of it.
Yeah, definitely, definitely living the life, and you know, thank you for all you've done to give back to the sport of off road and help it grow and succeed and be where we're at. And I mean, you know, give a guy like me, a chance to actually make a career driving a truck and doing radio. I mean, it's pretty amazing. And you were one of I guess the forefathers of off road. So thanks for everything you've done in the past and still continue to do today.
Oh, appreciate that. That's good. You know, I talked to Casey Folks a little bit ago before I called you, and he invited me out to Parker again. He said, you never come out to my races anymore. So anyway, I said, well, I'll get out to either the Mint or the Parker one of these next ones we have, and maybe we'll get together, Jim.
Absolutely. We'll definitely do it, and we'd love to have you here in Parker, and plan on it. So looking forward to that. I appreciate you for taking the time, my friend, and we'll definitely talk soon.
Okay, Jim. Can talk to you later.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Ivan.
Thank you.
Bye. All right. That was Ivan the Iron Man Stewart here on the Down and Dirty Radio Show. Stoked to have such a legend in the house on air with me. And I got to tell you, man, we are running behind. Had a great time today with Ken Block and Greg Godfrey. And Ivan the Iron Man Stewart, can't leave him out. But First off, want to thank all of you for listening in 3 years down, and you know, over 600,000 listeners to the show. It's pretty mind boggling. You know, without you guys, the show wouldn't exist. You know, definitely want to thank you. Got to thank all of our partners: Rigid Industries, Dirtfish Rally School, UPR.com, Blue Water Resort and Casino, Wakeboard Island, Racetech USA, Baja Junkies, Parker Motor Company, Ford, Jamar Brakes. Got to thank new partner, Polaris Razor. We are the Down and Dirty Radio Show, powered by Polaris Razor officially today. And also got to thank Ken Butch for being my my driver around here in Park City. Got to thank Greg Godfrey, Ivan Stewart, Ken Block. And once again, all you fans, listeners, anybody who's ever supported the show, posted, tweeted, gave feedback, or helped set up an interview or been a guest, thank you. Here is 2-3 more years. As always, game on, and we'll see you next week.